Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust way back in 2002, and goes out every Thursday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week, I'm afraid, Jason Yannakopoulos is stuck in Berkshire with floods. I mean, I'd seen the pictures, I'm sure you did, thinking they were the Somerset levels, but actually, it's the Thames Basin. But we certainly do have some guests for you. We've got Ed Lander, again, talking tech, and Danny Lopsch, who also does a programme here on BCFM, the Contemporary Christian Music Show. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, whose office is just off Queen's Square. You can call them on 0117 989 7733 or find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That's 989 7733, and I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. But to begin with, we're joined by Danny Lopsch. Now, Danny does a programme on a Sunday evening. I think the timing is 7. Is that right, Danny?
Yes, 7 p.m. on a Sunday, every Sunday.
Okay, and you're doing a contemporary Christian music show. So let's start with some of that contemporary Christian music itself. And we're going to start with a song called Dan Shui. Is that pronounced right?
I think it's Dan Shui. I'm not 100%
Shui.
Certain.
Okay, I'm glad you have these problems too, just as well as I do. And the band is called Transition. Transition is a Bristol band. The song, I hope I'm pronouncing it right, is Dan Shui. And I'm joined by Danny Lopsch, who does the Contemporary Christian Music Show here on BCFM every Sunday 7. Now, Danny, is that the sort of thing? I haven't really heard much of that on the local other radio stations. Are you one of the only people that plays this kind of stuff?
I think so. I'm not 100% certain, but one of the ways that I usually kind of promote the show is the self-proclaimed only hour of contemporary Christian music in Bristol. But I can't say that that's 100% correct, so it's my own interpretation.
This band, based in Bristol, I'd never heard of them, sounds quite good. I mean, it might sound a little bit of a crazy question, but I mean, do they play in a church?
They play. They kind of grew up. It's a trio of guys: Jesse and Josh Edbrook and Niall Dunn. So three of them making up the band: two brothers and a friend. The Edbrook brothers, they grew up in a church with their parents, kind of doing worship music in church. So I think they've been part of that. I don't think that's their normal sort of day to day thing.
Well, I can't imagine this in a Church of England, an Anglican, you know, setting. And I'm just trying to imagine myself into the sort of church where this music might be. You know, whether it's in the background or live, you know, recorded in the background, might be more the norm.
No, absolutely. So I think that that's one of the things that I like about contemporary Christian music, because we're talking about it's a very wide genre of music. People kind of call it as one genre, but it isn't. It's made up of multiple genres within that. And you've got your stuff that is typical kind of thing that you might sing in church. That's not typically the kind of stuff that I play on my show. I tend to go more towards the more sort of commercial side.
Right, so this is more the stuff.
Transition.
Okay, so the sort of stuff that you might, a Christian person might play whilst driving around in their car or
Absolutely.
Something, you know.
Yeah.
And tell us about yourself. You're certainly not from the UK. You've got a, I think, is it a South African or accent or something? Where were you born?
Very close. I was born in Mozambique in the Twin City, I think, for Bristol,
okay.
Which was...
Where is Mozambique?
Mozambique is on the east coast of sort of the southern end of Africa. It's just north of South Africa. So it sort of it borders okay. with Zimbabwe and South Africa.
And you say a twin city?
Yes, Beira. So I'm not sure if Beira is still the twin city for Bristol, but it was at one point in the sort of
okay.
recent
You were
past.
Born there, but
born there.
Do you have any much memory of it? Were you there for long or what?
Not a lot of memory. A beautiful sort of seaside city it was. We left when I was 3 years old. I went back once when I was five. So I've got a few memories of our home, very kind of scattered things. But not a lot of memories
from
there.
And then you went on to Zimbabwe.
Yes, it was Rhodesia at the time, which then later became Zimbabwean independence in 1980. And that's pretty much where I grew up, and that's where my accent is from. So very similar to a South African accent. I have a very strong, I suppose, white Zimbabwean accent, because sort of local or native Zimbabweans don't have the same accent. So I have a kind of old-fashioned white Rhodesian type Zimbabwean accent.
Well, I mean, Zimbabwe, highly politically charged country. I mean, there was, I think it was Unilateral Declaration of Independence back
yes.
in Zimbabwe, where the British government actually wanted to make the place independent in a different way, but the local people running it, Ian Smith and people like that, well, they weren't actually locals, they were Brits, should we say colonial Brits. I mean, where was all that going on as you were growing up? Is that way before your time?
So I think UDI was in, I think, around about 1969, I think, which was just before I was born. We moved to Rhodesia, as it was then, in 1974. So it was still under UDI with Ian Smith as the head of the government at that point. So I grew up there, grew up in wartime. There is where
wow.
I grew up.
So this was, although the white colonialists had declared a unilateral declaration of independence, the natives had decided, no, we're not having this. And this is the Robert Mugabe, I think, and Joshua Nkomo had set up
some
sort of, you know, a resistance movement, basically.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Interestingly, it's funny because looking now at sort of global terrorism, in those days when we grew up in Rhodesia, as it was then, how we referred to... the black uprising, we called them terrorists, which is quite interesting, because I don't think I would think of them that way now. They always called themselves freedom fighters, and I think that's how I would see them now. They were people who were looking for the freedom of their nation from colonial rule.
Now, what was the experience of you and your family during that? Because it was pretty nasty times in the 1970s.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, it's one of those bizarre things. I look at now that my children, when they were 12 or 13 years old, I wouldn't let them ride to school on their bicycles because I was worried for their safety. But for me, at 7 years old, in the middle of a war-torn country, and we lived in a town which was on the border of Mozambique, and a lot of the resistance or the freedom fighters were based in Mozambique, and they used to come across the border. So our town was quite often under attack, and I used to ride to school on my bicycle. So it's we lived in this atmosphere where the war was there, but there was still that element of freedom that doesn't seem to be around today. But yeah, there were scary things. You know, lots of times been woken up in the night, my parents dragging us and taking us into the bomb shelter or the makeshift bomb shelter. Had some bombs that landed around our house. The next day, sort of inspecting the damage. I've still got the tail fin from one of the bombs that hit our garage. I've got that at home. But largely, actually, my memories of that time as a child are actually very happy memories, even though we lived in that environment. I think because I was young, I was ignorant and naive to the actual danger that was around.
And you'd sort of been brought up with it, I suppose. You didn't know much different.
No. That I think for me, I think that was probably one of the great things with independence, because that suddenly that bit of life changed, and that kind of went. Suddenly we weren't at war anymore. But by that stage, I'd also moved to a different city, which wasn't so much on the front line of the battle, so to speak.
Okay, so I mean, you've already said that you're kind of supporting the native population there in their freedom struggle. What are your thoughts about today? Because Zimbabwe as it is now, it was Rhodesia, but Zimbabwe is seen as a kind of pariah state. And many people, I mean, certainly in the mainstream press, point to Robert Mugabe as really some kind of evil dictator.
Yeah, I probably tend to agree with those kind of thoughts. And it's quite hard, really, because it didn't seem to start that way. I think it started off with a man and a government that had really good intentions. I suppose sometimes when I look back at it, I was still quite young. So a lot of the views that I have are very personal, very biased, probably quite controversial. I probably grew up a lot of the time feeling quite a resentment towards Britain and Britain's hand in that whole process.
What did we do wrong?
I think I felt that when the transition to independence happened, that Zimbabwe was kind of left to fend for itself. And I think for any country that's rising up into independence, there needs to be that sort of hand-holding and helping. You've got somebody who's basically run a resistance movement, who's now having to run a country, has had no experience in doing that. And people need help doing that. They need to understand about, you know, the politics and the whole issue of running a whole country. And I think that's quite difficult to take somebody who hasn't had that experience or grown up in that environment and give that to them.
And what brought you eventually here to Britain?
Largely the political and economic situation in Zimbabwe, as that was starting to collapse. Financially, things were really difficult. I had a wife, two young kids. Education is not free in Zimbabwe. It used to be free for the sort of the most underprivileged classes, but generally education you paid for. So even a government school, although the government would say you didn't have school fees, every school charged a levy, and that levy effectively was school fees to be able to support the teachers. That was really used to bolster up their salaries and to run the school, the administration of the school. So the whole financial side of being able to try put our children into school was just outside of our reach, and things were getting really bad. The economy was starting to take a dive. That hyperinflation that we kind of people might be aware of now that happened sort of around 2008, that was starting back in 98, 99. It started then. Violence was escalating. There was a lot of rioting. The rioting is, if you were a person who had a lighter skin tone, you were an easy target in the riots. I think some people might say, I suppose I'm careful in saying that because it wasn't a racist thing. It's, I think in any time where you get crowds where there's violence, you're going to pick on the weak, and the weak will tend to be the minority, and white people are by far the minority in Zimbabwe. So very, very easy targets. So I didn't think it was about color, but certainly made us as white people feel quite vulnerable. And I had days where I would be saying to my wife, you're not leaving the house, keep the kids at home. So there were things, so those kind of two things together.
Okay, but that situation that was going on, I mean, to what extent was that just blundering, mismanagement, idiocy, if you want, by the domestic government in Zimbabwe? And to what extent do you think there were factors with the outside world, possibly economic sanctions, this kind of thing, pushing in and, you know, and affecting it? I mean, was it really simply just the fact that the government was incompetent?
I think at that point there was a lot of things that are happening that maybe weren't overly general sort of public knowledge at the time. I don't think it had a lot to do with sanctions at that point, because those hadn't come in. I think it's probably a lot around corruption and greed and mismanagement. So, Zimbabwe was involved in part of the war in the Democratic Republic of Congo. They were sending forces there. And as most people will know, war costs money. And that was draining the economy. And that started to impact the economy. And people started to react to that when they saw their day-to-day livelihood slipping away from them.
I'm talking to Danny Lopsch, who presents the Contemporary Christian Music Show here on BCFM on Sundays at 7. And we're going to be hearing a bit about Danny's life here back once he's come to the UK and his faith after some more. This next track, Danny, is the group is DC Talk and the song is Jesus Freak. Can you just tell us why you chose it?
I picked it.
It's a great title, Jesus Freak.
Yeah, it's I kind of see it as my theme song. I think sometimes if you brand yourself as a Christian and people know that you're a Christian, they kind of label you as, oh, he's that Jesus freak guy. And when I first heard the song, I kind of just fell in love with it. I was going to wear the t-shirt tonight, but I came straight from work. So it's a little bit of a theme song for me, and it kind of really sticks in my head and has done for 4 years. It's an old song, but one that I really like.
What will people do if they find that it's
DC Talk with a song called Jesus Freak. Joining me is Danny Lopsch, who does the Contemporary Christian Music show. Both those two songs we've heard so far, Danny, are like almost like walls of sound. Is that pretty much what the kind of stuff you play?
It is. It's a rough flavour. I think I play quite a variety of music. I think that's one of the things that I like to be able to do on the show. So I will play some stuff that might be sort of very sort of typical Christian praise and worship type stuff. I don't play a lot of that, but then a lot of the stuff will tend to go towards pop, rock, hip-hop, metal, and sort of all of those little bits in between.
What about hymns, gospel, and the more traditional sort of thing you might expect a Christian music show to be about?
Occasionally, there's one that I slip in, but it's not very often that I do that. So I'm trying to play sort of stuff that is probably more contemporary in the word of you know, in that sense of the word.
A bit more up to date. Okay. Now, you came to Britain from Zimbabwe when?
1999, about February the 5th, I think something is when I landed on UK soil.
And I mean, how did you find it? I mean, you were almost in a situation where you were finding things too rough in Zimbabwe economically. I mean, did you have everything sorted out in Britain, or did you just come back thinking, well, you know, I need to put my feet on the ground now? Did you have all the plans sorted out, or was it kind of a more of an act of faith?
It was a little bit of a step in faith. So I landed in the UK. I came in on a one-way ticket. I had a suitcase and a bag, and I think £2,000 in my pocket. That's everything that I had. And I came to stay. My wife's brother was here, and that was kind of and my dad and my sister were here as well. But that was kind of my base. I didn't have a job. I didn't have anything like that. I came 6 weeks ahead of my family, with the hope of trying to secure some work and then being able to bring them over afterwards.
And tell us a bit about how your faith developed. Or, I mean, what was your originally, I mean, when did you actually become a Christian? Were you always been a Christian, grown up as it, or was there some kind of amazing conversion moment?
No, I don't have one of these kind of amazing conversion testimonies. I think that sometimes you'll have people have. But for me, I grew up in a non-Christian home. We moved to Rhodesia, and a Christian family moved in across the road. They were friendly, they were nice, invited my mom to church, and we started going to church when I was about 5 years old. And kind of, you know, for me, kind of never looked back from there, because I started going to church then. I kind of slowly developed and grew in my faith at that point. And I didn't have a point where I could look back and say, oh, it was January the 16th, 1979 that I gave my life to God, or whatever expression you want to use. So for me, I kind of grew up that way. But it's probably only in the last 10 years or so where I really, really grasped more than just saying, oh yes, I'm a Christian, and oh yes, I believe this, or I believe that, where it actually became to say, no, actually, this defines me and my life as a person. And I only reached that sort of 30 years later in my life. But would have always said in all of that time, I would have called myself a Christian. I went to church, fellowshiped like that, and had those beliefs.
Just give us an idea of the difference in the characteristics of the type of churches, the kind of form of Christianity there is in the UK here, and what you left behind you in Zimbabwe.
Yeah, so I think I've been fortunate that I've kind of landed in a church environment that's not dissimilar to what I grew up with in Zimbabwe. So I grew up in a Baptist church. If there are any Baptists listening, I don't actually call myself a Baptist. I define myself more as a Christian rather than by denomination. But I've grown up in a Baptist church. The Baptist church is a little bit different because it's a little bit more charismatic than what I grew up with in Zimbabwe. But it's kind of, for me in that sense, it was just moving from one place to another and kind of continuing that same kind of environment.
Okay, charismatic, what does that mean?
Well, charismatic is probably a little bit more demonstrative in faith. So when singing hymns, people might clap more or sing a lot louder, whereas I grew up in a sort of a more reserved, I suppose, would be the right, which is quite bizarre, because coming to the UK, the epitome of reservedness. That's the opinion of most of the rest of the world. British people are quite reserved, which in my experience being here is not true. But it's funny that the church that I was in Zimbabwe was more reserved than the church I'm in here, and they're both Baptist churches.
And how do you see Christianity fitting in with other faiths? Because we're living in quite a multi-faith world, in a multi-faith city.
I don't know. It's really difficult to see how it fits in. I think at the moment I see the world as, yes, there are these different faiths, and I don't think they mold together. I think people like to have this idea that faiths mold together, and they do in some senses. They do in some senses that there's usually a moral basis or a code of ethics that people follow. So they have that kind of uniformity. But often I see that religions in some way aren't compatible. I think that's probably how I see them. And interestingly, I think we're seeing more now is disorganized religion, I think, is how I see it.
How do you mean by that? What do you mean?
I think it's people who wouldn't call themselves religious, or they don't follow a certain faith, but actually they do have a religious basis by which they live their lives on. And it might not be one that you or I or other people might agree with, but I think people have their own beliefs. So some people might believe very strongly in scientific things, and I kind of see that as going, that almost becomes their own little religion. So that's not an organized religion, but it's their own sort of personal one.
What about also Judaism? Christianity and Judaism, very, you know, maybe sometimes a difficult relationship, certainly at the time of Christ, back 2,000 years ago. You know, what he was doing was revolutionizing Judaism. So there's bound to be a bit of tension there. Do you think that there is still a good connection between the two faiths, and possibly, you know, on a side issue would be Islam, because they're all supposed to be based on the original Old Testament, aren't they?
Yeah. So I think certainly between Christianity and Judaism, it's quite a difficult one. So my personal view is, as I see it, is that the Jews are God's chosen people. So for me, I'm like a second rate family member. I'm a lower class within the context of God's kingdom, and that's how I see it. And I'm comfortable with that. Other Christians might not feel comfortable with that, but I do see them as God's people. I've had some links before. There's a ministry called Jews for Jesus, and they are Jewish people who are Christians, who are really looking and trying to move the message of Christ to the Jews, to show them that their Messiah has come. So I think for me is, I have a lot of love and time and respect for Jews and the Jewish faith, but I don't necessarily think that may be the case throughout all Christians, and I don't know that it works the other way from Jews to Christians.
This is one of the difficult things with Judaism, is of course you've got a Jewish race, but you've also got a faith, and yeah. Many of the people who are Jewish, many particularly Israelis, are actually originally white Europeans, you know, that they're not actually from the original Jewish heartland, homeland, which is the Semitic peoples of the Middle East.
Yeah, so they've been kind of westernized in some way.
Yeah, it's all so complex. What about Islam anyway? What about your thoughts about Islam and what its role is today?
I think Islam, it's quite difficult, because I think with any religion, I mean, I don't for me, Christianity isn't a religion. For me, Christianity is about a relationship with God, and but obviously in the context of what we're talking about, we are talking about religion and faith. I don't personally know a lot of Muslims, so it's a bit difficult for me to really say something that's actually got some meaningful context behind it. But I think quite often what we're seeing in the world is, we see people who are radical in their faith and people who are nominal in their faith, and the radicals can sometimes be behaving in a way that we don't find acceptable in the world. But there are some things about Islam that I find sometimes Christians have kind of lost. And one of the things that I think in Islam is very strong is the whole issue of covenant. And covenant doesn't make a lot of sense in modern Western society. And I think that's why when we see...
Well, what does the word mean? I mean, so, it's new to me.
Yeah, so for me, well, my understanding of covenant is it's a unilateral type of agreement that's made. It's a bit more than a promise. It's a little bit deeper than that. And it's a little bit based on, like, say, Tony, if I was going to say, okay, I'm going to make a covenant with you to paint your house. So basically what I'm saying, and then you saying, well, you're going to pay me certain amount of money to do that.
A contract.
But this is not a contract. This is a covenant. So this is slightly different. And the reason why it's different is if you make a covenant with me to pay me for painting the house, and I make a covenant with you to paint the house, whether I paint the house or not, you've entered into a covenant, so you'll pay me. And whether you pay me or not, I will paint your house because I've made a covenant to do that. So it's slightly different to a contract, because a contract says, well, you need to keep your end of the bargain for me to keep mine. Whereas a covenant kind of says, I will do this thing whether you uphold your part or not. And it's kind of one of these ancient things that stood around for a while. And I think what we see in Islam is that, you know, we see the reaction when somebody converts from Islam to another faith, or they leave Islam, and the reaction of that. Now, I don't agree with the actions that are taken, but I understand that the point of that kind of, it's almost the betrayal of a covenant, and I can understand the depth of that. So there's some things like that I can see, and I can understand whether I may or may not agree with the way that it's managed.
Now, I don't know how this interfaces with the fact that Islamic countries seem to be sitting on a fantastic amount of oil and natural resources, and that seems to be driving quite a lot of some of the political action in the world. Because, I mean, there is this portrayal, anyway, of a big battle in the Middle East between these two big faiths. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
I think there probably is, but I'm probably a little bit of a conspiracy theorist, I suppose. I kind of look and I think a lot of the wars that we have in the world are almost manipulated or controlled by a small number of people. And it's quite easy, if you've got two groups of people that historically maybe have had conflict between them, how easy is it to stir conflict between them now? I think that's quite easy. And I think that can be manipulated. So if there are people who've got money to make out of oil or out of weapons or things like that, that I think that emotions and hatred can be stirred up amongst people. And I don't always necessarily believe that that's stirred up inherently by those people and by the things that they believe in. I think there are external factors that impact that.
If you listen to people like the BBC, I mean, they put their daily service, which used to be for years and years, onto long wave. It's kind of marginalised. Their view is that Christianity really is kind of past its sell-by date.
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't agree with that at all. I think Christianity is something that is for all eternity. But I think that's probably because a lot of Christians hold to traditional values, and we live in a world that's kind of trying to move away from traditional values and say, well, those are old ways of thinking. And what's interesting is in the modern world that we live in, we invent new things, and they're wonderful, and we understand new things, and we have these new ideas, and they're fantastic. But not all new things are good, and not all new things are better.
There's nothing new under the sun, I think someone said once. Danny Lopsch, who does the programme on Sunday evenings, 7 p.m. here on BCFM, the Contemporary Christian Music Show, thanks very much for joining us. And just maybe you could finally tell us why you chose the group Rapture Ruckus and the song Hold On as your final song.
No, absolutely. I think one of the things that you've actually got me talking a lot tonight, and typically on my show I don't talk very much at all, and that's because I try to let the music do the talking. And one of the things that I kind of have a big passion and a heart for is being able to lift people up, the people who listen, the people of Bristol, trying to encourage people within Bristol to be better people, but also to be able to manage and to get through difficult things in life. Everybody goes through hard times, and I like the idea that maybe out of some of the songs that I play, it's been able to catch somebody who's having a rough time, a rough day, a rough month, a rough year, a rough decade, whatever it is, and been able to give them a little bit of encouragement. And for me, this song has lifted me up in times when I've been feeling really, really down. And it's that whole idea of don't give up, a better day is coming. And that's the song, Hold On.
You gonna make it through the rain.
Okay, the band there is Ratchet Ruckus, the song Hold On, and you've been listening to Danny Lopsch, who does the Contemporary Christian Music show on BCFM every Sunday evening at 7 p.m.
Bristol Community FM 93.2, your voice, your choice.
And I'm joined now by Ed Lander, who was here last week as well, a bit of a techie expert. Ed, just tell us, I mean, you did talk about it briefly last week, but, you know, why technology, why computers? Why does it do things for you?
It's just the complexity of it all. I need something to be stimulating, challenging, and the microelectronic industry is always moving at quite an amazing rate in terms of innovation. So it just gives me something to chew my brain over.
I know, one of the reasons I found that whole thing fascinating was reading back in the late 70s and early 80s, William Gibson, who was a writer looking ahead to this whole idea of, you know, information technology becoming ubiquitous all over the place, you know, rather than just one, whether it be newspaper or university or transmitter. You know, the idea of the internet sort of bringing universal also brings problems with it. And one of those big problems we've seen in the last 6 months or so is with the revelations from the NSA whistleblower, Edward Snowden, is this whole business of security. We need, I mean, the latest one is quite political, which is the government handing over our private medical records to a central database, which is then able to be sold. But I mean, this whole business of security, how does someone protect, and how do I protect my own personal data on my computer? Is it actually really possible?
I think that's a very good question. As soon as you have any internet connection to any computerized device, then it is technically vulnerable to access from an external agent, whether that's someone halfway around the world using a wired connection or somebody sitting outside your house in a car with a laptop trying to crack your Wi-Fi. So even if you think your information and your data is secure, it may not be, and it may be up to you to encrypt that data on your personal machine.
Oh, right. I mean, there is a program called PGP, Pretty Good Privacy.
Yeah.
That's one example of a pretty powerful one. So powerful that the United States government tried to get it classified as a weapon of war and banned.
Stop it.
but I mean, you know, my old-fashioned laptops, they had a little switch where you're switching on and off the Wi-Fi. Nowadays, it's an electronic switch. It's a really bit more difficult to know whether the Wi-Fi that's built into your laptop is actually being accessed, is switched on or off.
That's another fantastic point, that you may believe that just because you have no internet access that you're not connected to the internet, but who knows, honestly.
Yeah, so I mean, that it's all a little bit like smoke and mirrors sometimes, where you may not necessarily know that someone can see exactly what you're doing on your amazing that you can't access the internet, but the internet can access you. I mean, I don't know how many times people have really thought, could that really be so?
Well, I think a lot of people do now rely on third-party firewall software that alerts them to any accesses to the internet. So you may have a fairly innocuous program, some free photo editing program or so on, that you think would never have any need to access the internet ever. Yet if you have a decent firewall application, it will tell you that it's trying to connect to the internet and ask you for permission. Do you want this program to gain access? It may be looking for software updates. Who knows what it's doing.
Now, look, this is a bit cheeky, but firewalls are absolutely crucial. You're totally right. Are there any firewalls you would recommend?
I'm not an expert on the subject, and I would feel like I may be exposing myself criticism from experts out there by
Fair
recommending
enough.
Anyone.
All right, well, I will say Outpost. That's one I used. I mean, I just downloaded it. It seems to be very good. It does exactly what you said. Sits there, and every time one of your programs, and I must say it happens quite a lot, something that you've downloaded seems to do something you haven't asked it to
Absolutely.
Do.
Absolutely.
You know, this is pernicious in a way. It's a kind of like an ordinary innocuous program could actually be spyware sitting on your machine. Is
exactly.
that a bit too paranoid?
No, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, these days, a lot of free applications come with strings attached, whether it's advertising or sniffing your data. And if you install a typical free application on your smartphone, you are typically asked to approve it all kinds of access to your private information, and it will be coded in a way that it won't work unless you do that. And Facebook is the same, that the apps you install, you know, you might have some silly little quiz to see, you know, if your personality is closest to which Lord of the Rings character. And actually, it's asking for access to all of your personal information. So you're potentially horrifying. Giving away a lot there.
This is horrifying stuff. I mean, I've also read in the news recently, since Christmas anyway, another one of these Edward Snowden revelations is that the authorities, what should we say, GCHQ, National Security Agency, have been planting bugs on people's computers because they're annoyed because the thing isn't connected to the internet. They've planted a bug on your computer. Quite how they do that, maybe when it's in for servicing, or maybe they just get into your home, you know, and plant it while you're out one day, which is then enables them to remotely access a computer which has never been connected to the internet and on the face of it hasn't even got a Wi-Fi connection.
Yeah, well, you see that in the corporate sphere as well. I've worked for companies before where they're very, very careful about losing intellectual
property.
How careful? Well, they will install software on all their corporate laptops that not only monitor your behavior in the office, but if you take that laptop home and use it, even if it's not connected to the internet, everything you do, every file that you access will be logged. Even if you're just moving files from, say, an external hard drive to a USB stick on that laptop, that those file accesses will be monitored, and when you go back live into the system, it will be all those transactions will be uploaded and they will be scrutinized. And if you've done anything that's deemed to be intellectual property theft or doing something that breaks the company ethics, like moving pirated movies or viewing pornography, then you're liable to be sacked or disciplined.
And quite, I suppose it's fair to say that quite a lot of people are being monitored like that without actually being told by their bosses that's happening.
Absolutely. I mean, it's good that the company I work for was very upfront about it. And to be honest, I was quite shocked that they were so brazen and upfront and bold about it. And I felt I didn't feel relaxed at all working in that environment where every keystroke was recorded and potentially scrutinized.
Well, I can draw a comparison if you want with journalists and in journalism, where some of the contracts that journalists are forced to sign with these big media corporations actually say that everything you do, everything you write, whether it be a letter to your grandmother or is their own intellectual property, which is a little bit over the top as far as I can see.
Or anything that you've written on their property.
Not just on their property, anywhere.
Anywhere.
So you might write something somewhere else completely, or a personal letter.
Yeah.
I mean, some of these contracts are, I mean, I wouldn't like to name names, but I have seen details of contracts which I would say are absolutely unacceptable. But then, of course, you know, you want the job. You sign on the dotted line, and it's almost like they own your soul. They own your mind. Pretty frightening. But anyway, just as a practical, you know, final thing, Ed, could you just give us a basic security tip? What would you suggest?
Password, choice of password, password security. That's very important. Don't go using the same low security, easy to guess passwords everywhere, especially when it comes to things like your emails. Change them fairly frequently if you need to, write them down somewhere, but keep that in a safe place. And definitely don't choose passwords that are based on your house name or your pets or your children or something like that.
Okay, Ed Lander, thanks very much.
You're welcome. Cheers.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
And now I'm joined by Jeff Sparks. Jeff, before we do the What's On, I know you're a big keen fan of Thomas Chatterton. What's the latest?
Well, the latest is that the council and also the Chatterton Society have decided in the past month or so to come up with plans to turn the garden of Thomas Chatterton's house into a tea room.
Now, just to remind listeners, he's a Bristol poet. His old house is opposite St Mary Redcliffe Church, isn't it?
Yeah, that's correct, yeah.
So what are the plans the council have got?
I read in the local newspaper, the Bristol Post, they were saying that they wanted to turn the back garden into, well, the garden into a tea room sort of area. Indoors it was looking at maybe being part museum, part performing space. And, yeah, basically highlight the poet's life, really.
And where do they get these ideas from?
Basically, this idea that they've come up with is not their own, it's not original.
I suppose we're happy that they're doing something, but
I'm very happy that
they've done a bit of pinching of ideas. You reckon?
Yeah, I reckon they have. Yeah, I mean, it's great that, you know, we in Bristol are finally doing something to highlight this poet's life and his impact on, you know, the rest of the poetic, you know, world. But the idea is not original. I mean, I think they've taken it from an idea that myself and a former volunteer of Dialect, Anthea Page, had. And basically several years ago, I started a group called Save Historic Bristol on the internet.
That's right, on Facebook. And I remember one of your first members was Kerry McCarthy, the MP.
Yeah,
Save Historic Bristol, a great mission, Jeff. What happened with that Facebook?
Basically, it just petered out. It just vanished. There was just too much red tape going on. There was just too much, you know, coming up across too many brick walls, basically. And it was during the time of Save Historic Bristol that Anthea and myself came up with an idea of, well, mainly Anthea's idea, but she picked up the idea from me doing the Save Historic Bristol, but it was mainly turning the place into a tea room, having, like, indoors, a performance space, a bit of a museum.
Well, it would be nice, wouldn't it, if the council would actually acknowledge where they got the original idea for. Maybe ask you down to the opening ceremony, so we'll see if they can have the spine to do that, Jeff, in months and years to come. Anyway, over to the What's On Guide now, then.
All right, thank you. This is the What's On Guide from Dialect, and starting with Friday, 14th of February, Cash, who was a tribute to Johnny Cash, will be performing at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance, and doors open at 6:30 p.m. Also on 14th of February, Search Party will be performing with support from Tempus and also Vaults at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Entry is £4 on the door, and doors open at 7:30 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present Leonard Cohen. In a career that has spanned over 40 years, he has released 12 studio albums, 6 live albums, 5 compilation albums, and numerous singles. This is from Greatest Hits, which was released in 1975, and is the song Sisters of Mercy.
All the sisters of mercy, they are not departed or gone. They were waiting for me when I thought that I just can't go on. And they brought me their comfort, and later they brought me this song. Oh, I hope you run into them, you who've been traveling so long. Begins with your family, but soon it comes round to your soul. Well, I've been where you're hanging, I think I can see how you're pinned. When you're not feeling holy, your loneliness says that you've sinned. Sweeten your night. We weren't good lovers like that, and besides, it would still be all right. We weren't lovers like that, and besides, it would still be all right.
That was Leonard Cohen with Sisters of Mercy from the album Greatest Hits, which was released in 1975. Into Saturday, 15th of February, Mad Sin would be performing with support from Pussycat and the Dirty Johnsons at the Thecla in the Grove, Bristol. Tickets are £12 in advance and doors open at 7 p.m. Finally, on Sunday, 16th of February, The Defiled would be performing with support from Butcher Babies and also The Killing Lights at the Thecla in the Grove, Bristol. Tickets are £9 in advance and doors open at 6 p.m. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Thanks, Jeff. That's all for this week. Dialect's a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Thursday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Tuesday evening when Dialect goes online. You can do that or download this weekly podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our studio guests, Ed Lander and Danny Lopsch. Danny does the Contemporary Christian Music Show at 7 o'clock every Sunday evening here on BCFM. And also thanks to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, and you'll find them online at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week, goodbye for now.
No one told me about her, the way she lied. Well, no one told me about her, how many people cried. But it's too late to say you're sorry. How would I know? Why should I care? Please don't bother trying to find her. She's not there. Well, let me tell you about the way she looked. The way she acted, the color of her hair. Her voice was soft and cool, her eyes were clear and bright. But she's not there. Well, no one told me about her. What could I do? Well, no one told me about her. They all knew, but it's too late to say you're sorry. How would I know? Why should I care? Please don't bother trying to find her. She's not there. Well, let me tell you about the way she looked, the way she acted, the color of her hair. Her voice was soft and cool, her eyes were clear and bright, but she's not there. Don't bother trying to find her. She's not there. Well, let me tell you about the way she looked, the way she acted.